I've been a fan of filmmaker Rian Johnson for his movies like Looper, The Brothers Bloom, and of course Star Wars The Last Jedi, but I never even thought about him being a watch guy. A few weeks ago, though, he tweeted a link to a Hodinkee story, and I could not help myself from shooting him a message. We ended up eventually meeting up in Los Angeles, along with Hodinkee senior writer James Stacey, to record the conversation you're about to hear. It turns out, Rian is a pretty big watch nerd. I think you're going to enjoy this one. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Tudor. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at the Heritage Black Bay Chrono, a new take on one of Tudor's most iconic watches. You can also learn more at TudorWatch.com. Thanks so much for joining us, Rian. It's really good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we also have James Stacey here with us.
Hey, everyone.
Yeah. whole gang's here. So I wanted to start off, Rian, by just kind of letting people know how we met. You know, I've obviously been aware of your work and a fan of your work.
Steven and I shared a flat in Paris during the war.
We did. Yeah, we did. It was intense, but we got through it.
Yeah.
It's almost like a war, actually. Twitter, I guess.
Twitter's worse than a war.
It's worse than a war.
It's worse than World War II. No, jeez. Cut that part out.
We're starting heavy. We're coming in hot here. But yeah, I saw that you tweeted something we wrote and was like, wait, holy shit, is he a watch guy? And reached out and sent you a DM, just like slid right into your DMs, and then got an email a couple hours later, and we connected over the phone, and timing worked out great for this trip. So I'm really glad we could connect and talk about watches a little
bit. I've been reading the site for years, man. I've been a fan for years.
Unbelievable.
I was so happy you reached out. Yeah.
I was sitting, I live in Vancouver, so I phone into a video meeting on Monday mornings, and then we were talking about who's going to be, you know, in these episodes, and they're like, and we got Rian Johnson as well, and I was like, sorry, did you say Rian Johnson?
He had to unmute himself in the Google, took
a moment and unmuted and like adjusted my headphones, and I was like, the guy that did Looper, they're like,
who is Rian Johnson?
Awesome, I'll be
Dude's
there.
Like, cool, put his mute back on.
That's rad, because I adore Brick.
Oh, thanks.
Such a fun movie. My brother turned it on to me a few years ago, and just really, really excited to chat. It's fun.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We got a couple of good watch close-ups in that movie, too.
For sure.
It was the Timex that I wore like all through my 20s that Joe had on during that movie.
Oh, no, really?
It was really specific.
Is that something you think about a lot, is placing watches in your movies as a watch guy?
What's really funny is because I've only really gotten in any knowledgeable way into watches like in the past, like, you know, I don't know, 10 years or so. And so the Star Wars, you can't really place watches.
It's a little hard, yeah.
So, although it's tempting, it'd be pretty cool if just Han Solo was like rocking a Patek or something. But and then before that, Looper, I mean, there's a pocket watch that he has during it. And I thought about like looking at a specific brand of it, but ended up just going with, my prop guy found like a really interesting style with a really particular face, and I was just stylistically that looks good, and it's generic enough to where it's not going to take anyone out of the story. So
yeah,
and it's set in this weird future, so you don't want to date it using like it. So right. I don't know, but I do sometimes. I found myself watching movies that I love and just kind of squinting and saying, oh, what's
oh, for
he
sure.
Movie watch.
Yeah, movies, yeah. TV, shows I don't even care about.
Yeah.
James just watches
somebody
TV
else's
just
watching
for the
TV
watches.
And I'm like, oh, look at that.
Have you guys ever tracked down a watch that you found, like...
like hunted to find out what it actually
was?
Yeah. Oh, probably, yeah. Like, I mean, the big one is Cooper in Jaws.
What is he wearing?
It's an Alestra. They're actually doing a reissue of it. It just came out. It's like a skin diver, but on like a metal band style bracelet that has like big rivet holes in it.
That's awesome.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
No shit.
So that was like the grail on like Watch You Seek for many years, just trying to figure out what watch Hooper was wearing.
You gotta write a story about this.
That's a pretty great one.
It's pretty well covered. But,
wow, interesting.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's a cool piece.
And they're reissuing.
Now I can't remember. Is it Hooper or Cooper, his character?
Hooper, right?
Yeah, Hooper.
Yeah.
All right.
Have you ever tracked anything?
I've done it twice. I have to stop myself from doing it more because it could just be a rabbit hole. But I did.
That could be an interesting vein of collecting, though. Like, you collect watches you've seen in movies.
I'm very shocked that actually there's not kind of a whole subset of the culture that's in. Maybe there is, and I just don't know it. But
yeah.
After Hours, you know the Scorsese movie?
After, yeah.
Yeah. So because there's so many close-ups of Griffin Dunne's watch during the course of the night as his universe is falling apart, and every time it flashed to it, I was like, what is that watch? And it's actually, it's a Hamilton khaki branded, like the military style watch. And
okay.
This was before you guys did like the piece on it and with the reissue that just came out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's
the one that our producer Gray is wearing
over here
on the other side of the studio.
There you go. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. There it is. So this is before this came out. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a cool. And so I just went on eBay. And it was just, it was very cheap. I was able to find one.
Yeah.
Like one of those, the simple, like the Songbird
it's
ones.
Exactly. It's like this. It's much smaller than this. And it's got the khaki brand
that's cool.
on it. But yeah. Oh, that's really nice. Oh, sure. And then the other one, there's this movie, The Other Side of the Wind. Have you heard about this?
Oh, this is the Orson Welles thing, right?
Okay, so I've gotten to know... sorry, we're going to be talking for an hour before we even really start.
This is awesome.
Okay, All right, so I've been lucky to get to know Frank Marshall, the producer, who's Kathy Kennedy's husband. You know, Kathy runs Lucasfilm, so I've worked with her really closely with Star Wars. And Frank is a legend, and he's also kind of... he's kind of the Forrest Gump of the film world, not in terms of his intellect, but in terms of every time you start talking to him, he'll bust out another story of, oh yeah, I was hanging out with these guys while they were doing this amazing historic thing. It's just absurd. One of the things that he did was he worked in like the 70s with Orson Welles when Welles was making like his last couple movies. And he got into that through working with Bogdanovich. He was like Bogdanovich's guy on Paper Moon, Last Picture Show. I mean, he goes back like to the day and like, you know. So anyway, he got into working with Orson Welles on this last movie that Welles shot but never finished called The Other Side of the Wind. And it starred John Huston as this aging film director. And Bogdanovich actually co-stars in it as like his protege sort of. But anyway, Frank for years was trying to get a hold of the original footage. He finally did it. It was like locked in a vault in Paris with all this complex French bureaucratic bullshit, like keeping everyone's hands off. And he finally found a way to get everyone to agree and sign whatever they had to do. Got the footage, cut it all together into a movie. And I got to see it recently. They're going to premiere it. It's going to be on Netflix, like I think later this year.
Oh, awesome.
It's incredible. Oh, right. And John Huston... in that movie, they shot it like in the mid-70s, I think, early 70s. And he's wearing a Pulsar P2. He's wearing...
That is such a weird watch.
Weird. Oh, yeah. So strange that John Huston is wearing this, like, what would have been at the time, like a cutting-edge, like, you know...
It looked like the future.
Absolutely. Yeah, the 2001 inspired, and so I tracked one down, and I got one of those.
That's super cool.
Which, it's not actually that, I don't know, I mean, you can find them, and they're not astronomical right now.
Were you able to find one that works?
No.
Okay.
So that's the next step, is I gotta figure out.
Okay.
And it's so dumb, I'll still wear it around, even though
why not? Yeah, it's awesome.
But then I went to a YouTube rabbit hole recently, I was watching a bunch of Peter Sellers interviews from the early 70s, and I spotted him wearing one as well.
The same thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Pulsar V2. I was all these
dudes.
It's like
a weird cult watch.
I guess so, yeah.
They're probably all gifted each other then.
I'm sure. It's probably the same watch. Yeah.
They're friends, or one guy gifted all his buddies one and it's filtered through, something like that.
Very possible, yeah.
You have an Orson Welles question, don't you?
Not necessarily a question. I suppose it's more of a comment. You've seen his Paul Masson wine commercials?
Oh, well, yeah, sure. Of course.
It's like maybe the best thing on the internet,
depending
on your mood.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll have to link that up in the show notes.
Yeah.
Can you tell people what this is?
Yeah, it's just like, it's two takes. It's like if this interview went really bad, or if I had a really bad day.
And I wanted
to like try and regain some level of like positivity in my life, I would watch this clip.
Watch that depressing clip from when he's dying of alcohol and like botching this
it's so funny.
He's forced to do to make money. I get it.
You framed it in a way that robbed some of my glee.
That's my gift.
But,
That's my gift. I robbed joy.
It's Orson Welles attempting to deliver the the like two camera line about some like California faux champagne, and he's clearly unhappy about being there and possibly drunk.
Possibly.
He's most certainly drunk.
I'm just being charitable. And it's really, it's just, it's so stupid funny. It's so funny.
The drinking and in the same YouTube thing I went down, I watched a bunch of talk show stuff with Oliver Reed.
Okay.
And oh my God, I think Peter O'Toole and Richard Harris, like those guys, and you don't, it's so easy to slip into romanticizing it and you can't because it's, but it, seeing the, when those guys drank, like what that meant and seeing them, like if I get a little too drunk at a party, I'll wake up the next morning paranoid over what stupid stuff did I say at the party.
For sure. Right.
These guys were getting trashed more than I've ever gone trashed in my life and going on freaking Johnny Carson and like telling anecdotes. And I mean, it's completely bonkers. But John Huston in the movie plays, it takes place over the course of a night. And he is basically getting increasingly trashed the whole night. And
okay.
It's very obvious that, and you read behind the scenes stories, he was just drinking on set the whole time, and he's got that kind of, you know, it's an amazing performance. He has that kind of stone-faced gravity of just like, you can feel just his face looks like it's carved out of drooping, you know, stone. He's so drunk and just like, it's an amazing performance. Anyway.
Is that era of cinema something you particularly love?
I love it. I love the 70s, yeah. And I also, though, one of the nice things, my girlfriend, Karina Longworth, she does a podcast about old Hollywood. And so one of the really nice things about, like, the past, like, you know, past 5 years or so has been she watches a lot of old movies for her research. And so for me, it's like film school, and it's been a real, I mean, I to the point where if I sit down at night, you know, in our version of Netflix and chill is Filmstruck and chill, and we'll just put on like an old movie, usually something from, you know, the 40s or earlier. And I'd watch a lot of stuff from the, you know, 70s and 60s when I was in college, especially. But getting back into, you know, the previous era has been interesting.
What is it about that era that appeals to you?
What, the classic
era? Yeah, the classic era.
I don't know. I mean, I know some people, especially with the 70s, I think, who tend to romanticize the era specifically. I guess intend to kind of gild it as a... I can get that. Like, whatever, if that's something that romanticizes that makes it more meaningful, then I get that. But for me, it's much more about the individual films. And there were just some great stories that were told just by some amazing people. And for me, it's also fun watching very old films. We just watched a film the other night. I'm probably going to get the title slightly wrong. A Woman of Paris. It was a movie that Chaplin directed, but was not in. It was a silent film.
Oh.
And it was a drama. It's not a comedy. And they actually have, you can see the marketing guys, right? They're equivalent to marketing guys. That probably was just Chaplin, put a title at the beginning of the movie that said, you know, to the movie-going public, that Mr. Chaplin does not appear in this film. Also, it is a drama that he has directed. We hope you enjoy it. Like, just to let everyone know up front.
Right.
But anyway, you watch that and seeing this thing that in some ways has all these kind of formal things that make it so of another era and puts so many roadblocks up in terms of your modern sensibilities, and then watching an actress who has a scene where she is just so glowing and alive, and you feel like, oh my God, it feels like I'm watching somebody at a party yet last night having a great time. Something that just cuts through a century and the weird barrier of it being, you know, this flickering black and white old film, and you're just seeing this spirit, like a time traveler, you're seeing this spirit just alive on the screen in a way that just hits you between the eyes. I don't know. That's part of the fun of it, I guess.
Yeah.
It's also just damn good movies. So, yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
I guess. So
it is remarkable when films of an age manage to, like you said, kind of cut through all the expectations that you may have built up about modern films.
Absolutely.
Like every time I ramble about this film a lot, these three have all heard it from me, but North by Northwest, I'm loosely obsessed with because that movie doesn't age.
Loosely is generous.
Tightly obsessed. Me too.
It's an amazing film. Yeah. And there's some aesthetic parallels to Looper, intentional or otherwise. Well, just in the cornfield. And,
oh, well, sure. The cornfield.
That sort of thing. I always found that to be a very creepy sort of scene when it's shot a certain way. God. And it's reflected in both sort of spaces, I think,
The confidence of the silences of it. Yeah. And the confidence of how much of it is. It's not until the very final beat when the music kicks in, right? It's completely silent.
And you read that people freaked out in the theater because there's no music when the plane's chasing him and that kind of stuff. I mean, and you watch that now and the movie has lost nothing. It's lost nothing. It's just fantastic.
And that's something that I think, I don't know, even for myself, it's really, really hard to, you look at something like that, you look at David Lean's work, you look at the stuff they were doing, the steady hand they did and the confidence they had to make a decision like that.
There's a weird patience to older movies.
Yeah.
And it could be in the cut, just in the way the editing's changed.
Yeah.
But scenes take a little bit longer, like scenes that don't need to.
Yeah.
Take a little bit longer, and there's something nice about that I find. I don't know if it's calming or...
I agree.
It slows my brain down just a little bit.
I think people think you can't get away with it today. I really think you can. But it takes guts, you know. It takes... And I don't know. Yeah, it's a tough thing. But yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, some good stuff, certainly.
So good.
I mean, you talk about guts and acting with confidence.
Mm.
I mean, you recently, your most recent project, you wrote and directed a Star Wars film. That's I mean, talk about guts. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, how do you approach a project like that?
It's weird. It's like, I mean, when you, well, like, it sound, it, I got scared hearing you say that just now.
I could tell from the gulp.
The gulp. It sound, you caught me mid-water gulp. It sounds, and I think that it is just this strange thing where, you know, because I had grown up with Star Wars meaning a lot to me and really being my whole world when I was a kid and first telling stories in my head and everything, I think if I come into it as a job and thought as a grown up, can I execute this job so that it fulfills these, you know, these things, I think they would have just been paralyzing. But for something, because of what it was, I jumped into it and just instantly felt like I was jumping back into a sandbox from when I was a kid. There was something where that element of it that would have made it just terrifying very quickly disappeared, and I had the most fun I've ever had in my life creatively with it. It felt like play in a way that I you know, I like to think like serves the process well for it. But yeah, I don't know. It sounds scary, but once you get into it, it felt really comfortable. I don't know.
How much freedom did you have?
I had that. Well, that was the really nice thing is I had I had as much, if not more, freedom than I've had in my other films, in my independent films. And that's not what I expected coming into it. But I think, you know, Kathy Kennedy and Kiri Hart and the other folks at Lucasfilm and also the folks at Disney, they knew that they understood that all of them had known George and George Lucas, and some of the folks at Lucasfilm had worked with him on the film still. There are people who go back to when he was doing the prequels. And they knew that the original films that he made were personal things for him. And that's what made them what they were. And so they were real. It wasn't just like I was allowed to slip my own personal take on what Star Wars is into it. They actively encouraged me to not be afraid and to make it something that I genuinely connected with and cared about, something that came from my heart. Even if that meant it was going to be, you know, it wasn't going to be just like checking boxes of different kind of fan service things.
Right.
The ultimate way, as a fan, I think the ultimate way to service fans is to make a movie that's alive, you know, and make a movie that's, and that's what George did. And so I felt really lucky that the people, you know, up at the top, that was kind of, those were the marching orders. And I was really allowed to kind of find what I cared about and make it, which was cool.
And how would you describe that kind of personal stamp, the way that you made it yours? Like what about The Last Jedi is you?
Oh, I can't. I mean, you can't describe. No, it's not even just like because you don't want to say or because you'll sound like an asshole.
Right.
Although you don't want to say and you will sound like an asshole. But also just I think it's almost like I don't know. It's because I'm trying to think how to describe it. The process is so intense, and you just dive into it. You're making decision after decision that all add up to what the thing's going to be. And essentially, you don't have, I don't have time. It's not like you're consciously thinking about those things. You're just telling a story that feels right to you mm-hmm. and putting stuff that connects with you into it. And the sum total of all that ends up being the movie. And you're uniquely unequipped to define what it is that makes it yours when you get to the end of it, I feel like. You know, it's almost like asking, like, when you talk, what is it about your personality that's expressed and how you, and you couldn't define it, you know? It's,
yeah, that's totally fair.
Yeah.
If you were to pivot a similar question, if you were to say, with those marching orders, what did you personally feel you wanted to protect in the film that you appreciated about the ones that you grew up with?
I mean, for me, a lot of it was tone. A lot of it was the emotional response that I, as a kid, had to the movies growing up and remembering what, for me, what the with Empire Strikes Back, for instance, the ways that that was exciting in kind of a scary way to me, you know, and the way that also the operatic kind of thrill of some of the moments in that, the original, you know, A New Hope and Jedi, all of them, and tone, I guess, also the funness. That's one thing that JJ, among many things that JJ just nailed with The Force Awakens, I thought was the tone. He had just that fun, you're just on a ride and you want to be with these people type tone. So the humor of that, trying to get that in, I don't know, it's a whole bunch of stuff that kind of adds up to all the stuff, excuse me, that I love about Star Wars.
I thought it was remarkable how well you were able to maintain the big, small moments that existed in the original three movies, where they could show you something that was happening at a galactic level, and then show you something that was happening at a very human level, and they were contrasting nicely. Like, I find you watch a lot of comic book movies, and the comic book movie, and that's not, of course, not what a Star Wars movie is, but the comic book movies have become a genre in themselves where you have some very strong people and then a stronger person, and then they find a way to beat them, and that's the end of the movie, and they do that again and again and again and again. And with these things, it seems that there's always a humanity within Star Wars.
I think that's what there's always been. Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Yeah, and that's something that that is another really nice thing that I think JJ honed into, and that all the folks, again, at Lucasfilm and Disney were cool with, because there is that thing. So Damon Lindelof, that wrote a really great piece about what did he call it? Scope creep, where there's just a natural tendency to have the world blow up at the end of every, you know, and there is like a story gravity that says make it bigger to make it more, you know. And I think everyone involved in this kind of recognized that, you know, that's not entirely what's, there's that in Star Wars, but that's not what makes Star Wars tick.
Right.
I guess. That's good. That's great that you felt that.
Yeah, really, I mean, cool. even like the scene that comes to mind, like, because I wouldn't want to give anything away for someone who hasn't seen the film, but, you know, the sequence with the bombers. Is at the same time, this is in an opening sequence of the film, roughly speaking, you know, first act. And the sequence of the bombers has, of course, a huge bombing raid happening with huge ships, and it's at a very macro level. And then you have this one instance that's very tightly shot on someone's face and someone's hand on something they're supposed to touch. And to blend those two things together, that's like, that's done by people who, it's done at a high level by really good war films.
Yeah.
They'll do two things at the same time. You'll see the macro size of a war and then the micro of being a pilot or a guy reaching for a gun or something.
Well, it was
like
really
that.
Interesting cutting that sequence and some of the space sequences together. One of the things and this was a real education for me that I learned really quickly, was you emotionally disconnect so fast if you don't cut to a human face.
For sure.
Really often. And that sounds obvious, but it's incredible how seeing it in practice, in seeing how even if you go a couple of shots, just that it sounds like just something you'd say, like, you can't emotionally connect to a spaceship. It really is true. You can't emotionally connect. You have every few shots, you got to go to somebody's face and know what's at stake and know you like the person and they're in danger. Yeah.
And I thought it was a powerful scene and just something kind of stood out in my mind, because that, for me as a kid, that's what these movies were about, were these big scenes.
Yeah.
And then these very personal scenes, father-son scenes,
absolutely,
childhood scenes,
absolutely,
losing, scenes of great loss, very personal things that, you know.
Yeah.
So what, Luke lost his family. That wouldn't matter to somebody that didn't know Luke, but you know Luke.
Right.
It matters to you.
Exactly.
And then at the same time, you have something that's happening on a grand scale and he's a key in kind of a big lock. And I think that carried over into your films as well.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you.
It's just a neat story structure that I think is not certainly not unique to Star Wars, but is very well played throughout that series.
Yeah, it's a big part of what makes it what it is, but I'm glad that came through. It's definitely something we had our eye on.
And now we'll look at this week's sponsor. Over the last few years, Tudor's Black Bay line has been the gold standard for watches that combine a respect for watchmaking history with modern craftsmanship. The Black Bay Chrono adds an additional complication to the Black Bay family, but all built on the foundation of the iconic snowflake-style hands and the sturdy Black Bay profile. Inside beats the manufacturer caliber MT5813, a column wheel chronograph movement which is chronometer certified and fitted with a silicon hairspring. The Tudor Black Bay Chrono is bold and modern, but with just the right dose of nostalgia. Visit your local authorized retailer to see these watches in the metal or TudorWatch.com to learn more. Let's get back to the show. It's interesting, too, for me to think about that in terms, or I guess not in terms of, but in maybe contrast or comparison to something like brick, right? Mm. It's such a different scale and a different, in some ways, a different type of story.
Ooh.
How do you, I guess, what would you see as kind of unifying kind of storytelling methods between these two types of stories? I mean, brick is something that, you know, I know it was shot in the school you attended.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very human level, personal story that is shot and takes place in a place that's very personal to you and is written by you.
Yeah.
Trying to tell that story versus jumping into Star Wars, which is something you're kind of stepping into and is happening at a very big scale and a scale that's like not very tangible day to day for us.
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach telling those two types of stories similarly or differently?
Well, I think you have to make them the same, and it's weird. Like I see more similarities. Like brick was in the way you described, like a more intimate thing for a lot of reasons. It also, though, it's a weird movie. Like in terms of like formal stuff that should be like a barrier to emotional entry, you could argue it has even more stuff than something set in space with the weird way everyone talks, and it's kind of this bizarre high school world, but it's not really like a realistic thing. Like but anyway, the trick I think for me with both of them, it's the same. And it's strange. Like Star Wars didn't. I feel like this is a version of what I said before in terms of just having the creative freedom to make it personal. But excuse me, Star Wars didn't feel like I don't know. It didn't feel like stepping into something bigger necessarily. I feel like it can't. You know, anything you step into, if you don't feel it on the same level that you feel the small indie movie that you're making and know emotionally why it matters to you in the exact same way and know, sit down to scene, know what that scene is about in a way that you can express in personal terms for these characters and why that connects with you. It doesn't matter if it's a small indie mystery or drama or whatever, or a massive space movie, it's not going to work, you know? So for me, it's strange, like hearing the question, like I never really thought of them as different things, I think, you know.
In making movies, when you're trying to translate an idea to not just the visual side, but to make the story, what's the challenge that someone who's never done it before would not appreciate?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. I think, you know, for this, so with in terms of screenwriting, in terms of telling a story that's going to keep an audience actually entertained for like 2 hours in a theater. For me, and this is still the most challenging part of it, is, you know, when I was a teenager, my dad was in the home building business. He wasn't in entertainment business at all, but he was fascinated with movies. And I think he secretly wanted to make movies. And so he took a screenwriting course, and I was like 17, and we drove up to LA together, and he brought me to this screenwriting course. It was Robert McKee. It's the guy, do you know Adaptation?
Movie? Of course. Yeah.
It's the guy they're making fun of in Adaptation.
Right.
Yeah, that's him. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And so it's, he has a very pedantic sort of like, you know, style. He gets, you know, a lot of people making fun of that. Everything I know about screenplay structure, I learned from that weekend in that class with my dad. And the basics of it are just, there is, in terms of the story of a screenplay, in terms of, there's an element of engineering to it that hopefully is invisible to the audience, but as an audience member, you know if it's not clicking. And it just basically is it's all about reversals, and it's all about, you know, every 15 minutes, something pretty interesting has to flip around, and every 30 minutes, something bigger has to flip around. And over the course of the whole movie, something massive flips from the beginning to the end. And it's, there is an element of that where it sounds kind of obvious, but as a screenwriter, it's easy to just say, and then this happened, and then this happened. It takes a certain amount of conscious discipline to say, okay, what's really going to make you say, oh my God, now this is happening. Oh crap, now this is happening. And, you know, and, I don't know, I'm not expressing this very well, but that to me is both the most interesting and the most difficult part of screenwriting is there is a discipline to it. There's an element of bridge building, of engineering that you have to pay attention to if you actually want someone to stay in their chair for 2 hours.
And do you figure that's craft? You do that at a gut level, or you write it and then you go back and say, like, well, we could tweak this to kind of build a little, bring them up a little higher here.
It's a combination. Yeah. I think it, to a certain extent there are, because you meet people who aren't screenwriters who can just tell a great story, even if it's just an anecdote about what happened to them yesterday. And you meet people who they could have, this is something I think McKee actually says, it's really true. You meet people who they could have just almost crashed in a plane and barely survived and ran a, stolen a horse to ride across the desert to get water and live. And then when they're telling it, you're nodding off because they're not telling it well. Right. I think there is a certain degree of innate storytelling that somebody has or doesn't. But at the same time, you know, a script has, it's, having that helps, but it there is, like I said, I keep coming back to the word engineering. There's just an element.
There's an evolution to it.
But then you hear stories, like I've heard the Coen brothers just start writing at page one and just feel their way through it. So I guess if you're
of course they do.
If you're actually talented like the Coen brothers, then yeah, I'm not. Spoiler alert.
How do you approach directing something if it's something you've written versus something that you didn't? Because I know you sometimes work as a director, and sometimes you're writing and directing projects.
Yeah.
Is it for you a different process, or is it sort of like with Star Wars where you just have to sort of slip into the material? And
it's sort of the same. I mean, excuse me, it's sort of the same. And the only time I've directed something I haven't written has been with TV, with Breaking Bad. So where, first of all, the writing was better than anything I could ever write. The writing was just magnificent. And I mean, writing sucks, man. Writing is miserable. And I don't believe anyone who claims to enjoy writing. So it was heaven for me to just show up and basically do the fun part, which is working with the actors and directing this great script that someone else had done the work of writing. But no, and also though, even when you write something and then direct it, or I find this, there is a weird kind of schizophrenic split that happens where you show up on set and the person who wrote the script is a different person who you come to resent over the course of shooting. You're like, who the hell wrote this line? And I find that I become instantly very unprecious about the script. And there is a weird disconnect where you're coming in and it's like you're in the trenches now and you just have to make the scene work. And it's not about staying true to what you were thinking when you're sitting in front of your little, you know, computer like 6 months ago. It's about, no, this is boring. Why is this boring? Let's do what we have to do to make it work.
Do you find yourself doing that even when it's a script you wrote as well, where it comes out of someone's mouth and you're just like, oh, that does not work?
All the time. Oh, okay. All the time. And that's why I'm really collaborative with the actors. We'll run through it. If we can lose a word, if we can lose a phrase, if something's not working, if it's not clicking, that's one thing that I've definitely tried to get better at and have learned. That's one of the biggest things I feel like I keep learning is the degree to which you know, you have to know what you're telling. You have to know why certain things are there. You have to know the intent of it all, but not being precious and realizing if something doesn't look like it's working, it's not working, and you gotta change it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And considering you'd said that, you know, nobody likes writing, I assume it means you don't like writing so much.
I think some people like writing.
That's fair. But the for you, do you find that your buzz, where you really find your sweet spot, is in those scenarios where you're in the trenches, like you said, and you're making it work?
I mean, there's nothing more fun than that. At the same time, I mean, you know, you hate writing, but you love writing. You know, there's nothing better.
I feel that.
Yeah, there's nothing better than when...
Especially when it comes together.
Yeah,
that's when it clicks. That's a good feeling, right?
Yeah.
When it clicks. And I love having written. That's like...
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's definitely better than writing, for sure.
Yeah. So doing it is tough, but when the results come together, it's...
Exactly.
It's a good feeling.
There's nothing better than when you like you've been trying to figure out how to write your way out of a situation, and suddenly just, oh my god, that's it, and that'll be amazing. You said that there's nothing better than that feeling, you know.
But, or clicks, or something your brain gets out of its own way and it works out.
Exactly. Yeah, it's so rare.
Yeah.
So rare.
So to bring it quickly back to kind of almost where we started, you know, when you and I were talking about watches the other day, you know, you mentioned that when you got the call for Star Wars, you picked up a Speedmaster.
Yeah.
Are there other kind of milestones or exciting moments that you've marked with watches?
Yeah, I feel like, excuse me. I feel like with like the watches I picked up over the years, and I don't have a collection that would impress any regular hodinky reader. It's not like I have like amazing watches or something, but each one of
them.
You
have Star Wars.
Huh? I don't have a Star Wars. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true. But you have a Star Wars watch.
You also have a really nice Explorer on right now. I think that's a watch. Hodinky readers would love.
Yeah, mm-hmm. this is my baby, my new baby. But each one, I don't know, each one of them though, and I think this is probably true with everyone who's into watches to some degree, each one of them tells a story of that moment in your life, you know? And so each one of them in its own way is kind of like a milestone. And when you put it on, you remember who you were when you got it, where you were, why you got it, why you loved it, you know? And I think with that's one of the cool things. And for me, especially with, because I've found, I've gotten a few newer watches over the years, but I've really come to find that vintage watches are really where my heart's at. I think it's the combination of, the combination of that storytelling of what the watch meant to you when you got it, and then the watch itself has a history before that maybe you know about, or maybe you can look at it and imagine and tell yourself as a story. And
for sure.
Just like, and that the combination of those two things and having that encapsulated in this beautiful machine on your wrist, I mean, it's just really powerful, I think, you know. But yeah,
totally.
The Speedmaster was, I was about to go off to do Star Wars, and I had, at that point, I had a few watches, but, and I had gotten a few watches over the years, but it was when I put that Speedmaster on my wrist and looked
at
it.
What sort of Speedmaster?
It's a, it's pre-moon, it's called pre-moon, 1969, and so it's a, I forgot, I looked up.
A 145?
I used the app to look up the number of it,
and I promptly
forgot it. I know it's 69. It's nothing special. It's not but I put it on my wrist. I remember sitting in the car after I first put it on, just looking at it, and it was like just that first moment. I think everyone's into watches has that, where it's like, oh, this is my watch.
We talk about things clicking. It's like that moment where it just feels right.
Yeah, and the fact that it was, you know, a Speedmaster, the fact that it was pre-moon, but the moon watch, and I was going off to do Star Wars. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. And
doesn't get any better than that.
And then, and now, because I had it on my wrist the whole time I was making Star Wars, now when I put it on, it reminds me of all the great memories when I was on set making it, and it's, you know.
It's fantastic.
It just all connects up, yeah.
It's fun how, especially old watches, but watches in general can connect with those.
Yeah,
with those experiences become kind of totems or credits or something like that that you kind of
completely they connect up to. When I was in London working on Star Wars, you guys published a thing about the Dirty Dozen, and I'm trying to think if that was, maybe it was after I was in London, but anyway, I got really into reading up on British military watches.
Yeah,
when I was in London, I was originally looking around for a Mark 11, and I found a gorgeous Mark 10 that I ended up getting.
Okay.
And so it's, it's so beautiful. And it also, talk about storytelling, it has a, you can see a slight fade on the dial where the minute hand was stopped.
Oh, where the hand was stopped?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Isn't that incredible?
The like radium burn on
so you just picture how many years this was sitting in like some, you know, you like to imagine.
It's
like
so cool.
Some dude's like case, like with the sun sweeping over it once a day for like 30 years. But also just the connecting up to the time in London, like that was a fun way to, and I was, because I'm in my 40s now, of course I'm reading a bunch of World War II history. That's what everyone does.
Kind
of
have to.
40s
for sure.
Is legally required. Uh-huh. And so, you know. But everything like connects up, you know.
Tell us about your Explorer.
This Explorer, it's a 1016. It's from 1965. I had my eye on getting an Explorer for a while. I knew I wanted something that had a little character in terms of the dial. I figured, well, I'll look for something that maybe has a little tropical kind of discoloration or just something unique about it that I can kind of... And I've been poking around, and then I'd also kind of just asked a few friends of mine who were like, you know, kind of in the watch world to keep an eye out. And a buddy of mine found this from just like a private seller in New York, and it's 1016 has got it's incredibly clean, it's beautiful, and the dial is this uniform caramel color. And it came actually on a bracelet. It came on like an oyster bracelet. I wear it on a leather strap, and just the combination of the rich brown leather strap with the face. I love it because it's a really special watch for me. It was something that I really kind of prized, and yet on my wrist, like unless you know watches, you wouldn't look twice at it. You know, it just kind of is a nice watch. It just kind of disappears. But yeah, and my excuse me, yeah, the first watch my dad had a gold Datejust from the early 80s. And, you know, on like a gold Jubilee bracelet, it was like a lot of gold. And, that was the watch that he wore when I was a kid. And he gave it to me in 2002.
Okay.
And, like engraved the back, and it was really nice, but I don't know. Yeah, for me at that moment, it was like a big gold Rolex, you know, and it's weird. Like you know, we were talking a little bit about this before, and we talked a little about this on the phone. Like, you hear, I think a lot of people's experience with watches always start with, oh, my dad gave me his watch, my grandfather gave me his watch.
Right.
I wonder how many of those stories have kind of, I don't know, because for me, I was like conflicted about that watch. It's interesting. My dad was a wonderful person. We had kind of a complicated relationship, and a lot of that stuff went into my feelings about this watch that for me, in a way, signified a lot of the stuff I felt like I didn't want to emulate about my dad in a weird way. Not to turn this into therapy.
No.
But anyway, so I took that, I kind of put it in a drawer and didn't think about it for years, you know? And so the other nice thing about getting into learning more about vintage watches has been learning and appreciating more about Rolexes and about that watch and about, you know, and now I'll develop more of an appreciation. And so, you know, the first day of shooting on Star Wars, I wore my dad's watch. You know, when we wrapped, I wore it. When when I worked with Frank Oz doing the Yoda scene, I wore the watch.
And it's cool. Talking about big days.
Sure. Yeah, well, because he passed away like 5 years ago, so he wasn't around for the shooting. So it's become kind of a way to connect with him, you know. But for me, I guess this is my way of also sort of finding my version of my dad's watch, you know, which is another storytelling thing that helps connect it all up.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Do you ever find, you know, speaking of wearing watches on set, do you ever find that wearing a particular watch on set ends up connecting you to other people on set or other people that you're working with? Have you built connections that way?
I haven't, actually. It's strange. I mean, there's... Excuse me.
We can come hang out if you want.
Okay,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, we'll come hang out.
That's what we need.
Anytime you want.
That's what we need. I don't know why, but they're
you can bring watches.
Yeah, please do. Oh my God, are you kidding me?
We'll bring watches and coffee.
Let's do it. Done. Oh my God. No, you see a lot of nice watches, like a lot of the heads of department. You see a lot of Submariners. You see a lot of like really nice watches, but no, I don't know why. It's very rare, actually. That's why it's so much fun getting to come here and talk. I have a very good friend of mine, my friend Noah Segan, who's really is an actor, and he was in Brick, and we've been good friends since then. He's very much into watches, and so it's nice to have one good friend who we can like send each other Instagram links back and forth and drool over.
You gotta have somebody to swap stuff with.
I know.
Half the fun is blowing people's Instagram up with stuff they should buy.
Completely. Yeah. And we have very different taste in watches too. He's like, his like Grail watch is like a root beer GMT.
Okay.
And he's very into kind of like that, you know, 70s sort of gold, you know, and that's the opposite. So it's fun going back and forth with him.
Is there anything that's your Grail watch?
I mean, I feel like I have to cover my Explorer if I say anything, because honestly, no, I'm in that honeymoon where it's just like, no, this is the perfect watch.
Hey, I have an Explorer on my wrist right now too, and feel the exact same way. So
really.
Understand.
Well, there you go. I'm trying to think if there's, you know, there's one watch I've never seen in person, but every time I see it, I'm just like, that looks like maybe the perfect object. It's the, It's a Patek. It's the Amagnetic, the 3417.
Ooh.
Stunning in steel.
I love that watch.
Oh, it's gorgeous, isn't
amazing.
It?
Amazing. With gorgeous. That script.
Oh, it's so beautiful. I don't know what it is, the combination of everything with it. And I just would just love to see one in person someday. It's also in the range of, you know, it's in the range where it's morally questionable to ever spend that much money on a watch, even if you had the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
I know that price range very well.
Yes, it's that range. It's stunning. But no, right now I'm in that happy place where I'm just incredibly happy with what's on my wrist. It's a good place to be.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You should tell your buddy Noah about, have you seen Firefox, the Clint Eastwood film, 1982?
Not since it came out. Right. Oh,
he has a Ruger GMT in that.
Well, does he really?
He always wore them, right? In real life. I think so. I think Eastwood always wore Ruger
Oh, really?
GMTs.
I didn't realize
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So John Milius, too.
Oh, no shit. Yeah, that was his thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
He had a good one right at the end of that documentary, Milius.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
They're doing a little bit of an interview just before he passed.
Yeah.
And he's got the, like, just a fantastic
movie watch spotting. Let's start our own podcast, movie watch.
Done. Sure.
Are you kidding me?
Done.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, Firefox, there's a scene where he's following somebody along through Russia before they steal that plane.
Yeah.
It's a fun movie. Like, it's a cheesy movie, but it's pretty fun. But he like glances in like a beam of light, like a snooted.
Oh, my God.
It's good.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's fun.
All right, this is a story you're writing for next week.
Done.
Consider it a sign. There you go.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
So cool.
Cool. Well, every episode, we like to finish things off with a little bit of a culture recommendation from our guests. So it can be anything. It can be a film. It can be a book. It can be something you worked on. It can be something totally random that you're just into right now.
If I had to recommend something, I feel like this is getting recommended and a lot right now, but not as much as it ever should be. You know, have you seen the show Killing Eve?
No, I haven't.
Ooh, I'm turning you on to something good here. Okay, good. All right,
just
excellent
choice.
Oh, they see you searching. Firefox. Yeah.
Producers are now looking right now.
Yeah, Killing Eve. It's a BBC America show.
Okay.
It's kind of like a short series season of a series. I think it's not on Netflix. We got it on iTunes.
Okay.
But it is fantastic, and it's about a Sandra Oh, who is an actress I've always known was good, and then I saw her in this role, and it's like Cranston in Breaking Bad. It's just like, oh my God, she just is incredible in this part. She plays she's living in London. She works she kind of works as a spy, and she gets, but she's like a low level sort of bureaucratic paper pusher to a certain degree, and she gets pulled into the hunt for this international assassin. And this sounds very cliched.
It sounds great.
Everything the show does, every choice it makes is the opposite of cliche. And just every single episode, there's something that makes you go, oh crap. And it's so beautifully made, and the performances are so good.
Awesome.
Killing Eve, highly recommended.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's super. Sounds great.
What you guys got for me?
So in a similar vein, you know, we hope that everybody's listening to this has seen Looper, a great movie with a solid time travel hook, right?
Aww.
I would recommend the 2004 film Primer by Shane Carruth.
Which
love him.
How have we not talked about this yet?
It's a thing. That movie's a thing for
sure.
I
love that movie.
It's really raw.
You know, I'm friends with Shane.
Oh, really?
For years. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Through that movie, I got to know.
It's something, right?
Have you seen Upstream Color?
No.
No.
Oh, okay. Am I allowed to slip a second one? It's a second movie.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Yeah. It's his second movie. If you like Primer, check out Upstream Color.
Upstream Color and Primer. I mean, we'll double down to Shane Carruth.
Nice pull with Primer. It's a great
Primer's
movie.
A fantastic one. Movie, I'm not going to say anything more than needs to be said because the movie does not want to be explained.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to try.
But also, good luck explaining.
Yeah, there's also that too. I can dodge that one on premise alone. But it's a fantastic movie with a time travel conceit that's very clever and super deep and doesn't really get in its own way, which is tough for time travel movies. So
awesome.
That one and now Upstream Color as well. So I have something to watch on my flight home.
Good choice.
Sweet.
How about you?
I'm going to go with a book. So there's a book called The Secret Lives of Color. That my wife got for me as a gift maybe 6 months ago, and I finally plowed my way through it in little bits and pieces. And it's a series of short essays about colors, and it's very detailed. It's not yellow and blue. It's aquamarine and ultramarine and cerulean, and literally like pigment by pigment. And it goes all the way back to the raw materials that these colors were sourced from, the histories of how they were used in art and architecture and design and film, and essentially decodes the way we see the world.
Sounds
color
amazing.
By color. And it's extremely fascinating. And there's all kinds of strange stories, including, you know, adventures halfway across the world, ground up bugs, civil wars. It's really wild. And it's essentially a book about a whole bunch of things you take for granted and making you not take them for granted anymore.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I finally finished it recently and highly, highly recommend it.
Nice. That sounds so good.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. This has been a super fun, super fun episode.
This has been great. So much fun. Let's
really
do it again.
Cool.
It was a blast.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, man. Thank you.
Thank you to Ryan and James for joining us. This week's episode was produced by Grayson Korhonen and was recorded at the Network Studios in Los Angeles. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.